So good evening, everybody. There was a glitch in the schedule, but I hope you enjoyed that half an hour. It was a pretty sunset anyway. It was nice to be out there. So tonight's talk is going to be on the second Brahma Vihara, which is Karuna, compassion. And I wanted to start tonight's talk out by telling you a story, a personal story. So this happened a few summers ago, just a few days before I was going to leave on a pretty intensive two-week retreat. One of my very dearest best friends, who was also actually my retreat manager, discovered one evening that she had a brain tumor, and the very next day she was gone. She was in the hospital and didn't come out of her coma, and I didn't get to see her until the morning. I got to say goodbye, but she was already really gone. She was in a coma. And it was a complete shock, of course, to everyone, her husband, children, family, all her friends. She was in her early 50s, just full of life, actually just one of the kindest, most sweetest, compassionate people I know, and had a lot of friends, and it was a shock. And her funeral happened pretty quickly after that, and instead of staying home from my retreat, which is actually really suggested if you've had a sudden major loss, I decided to do it, to go on retreat. Since I'd planned it for about a year, it's my kind of annual winter retreat. I go up to the Forest Refuge. It was really kind of late to cancel, and I convinced myself that it would probably also be a really good time to just be by myself and really honor my friend by spending time just grieving her in that way, spending those couple weeks. And some of you may have known this place up in Massachusetts called the Forest Refuge Center. It's a small private retreat center for mostly more experienced students, and teachers go there a lot. And what it is instead of a situation where you're having a lot of guidance and teaching, most of the time you're kind of in your room. You have a single room, and you're in your room alone meditating and practicing. And there are a couple teachers there who give a Dharma talks maybe a couple times a week, short Dharma talks. And then you have once a week, 15 minutes to talk to a teacher, to talk to anybody. So you're either, you know, sitting in your room or practicing walking meditation or taking long walks in the woods, which I thought would be great. But essentially is what I signed up for when I went on retreat. You know, when I go on retreat, that's what I sign up for. I want just to be in the silence with not a lot of interruption, just by myself. I was really looking forward to that. But when I got there, I was so quickly realized that it was the absolute opposite of what I wanted. I was grieving, and so what I really desperately wanted was companionship and someone to hold me, someone to talk to, and offer me some empathy and compassion. And I didn't have any of that. I literally was required not to talk to anybody. Just like you all are here, I was quite required not to talk to anybody. And so at first, one of my biggest lessons on retreat might best be expressed by the teacher Ram Dass, who said, "You need to learn to keep your heart open in hell." You need to learn to keep your heart open in hell. And it really felt like that. It was really just exposed. And of all the retreats I've ever attended, this was probably definitely the most difficult, and also, on the flip side, also the most fruitful, since honestly, as most of you know, most of the difficult ones are. You know, we bow to that because there's so much learning in that if we can stay with our hearts being in hell. So what happened was that, in essence, those 2 weeks turned out to be an intensive boot camp in self-compassion, since very literally it was completely up to me to give myself the compassion and empathy that I needed, since no one else could. So again, it turned out to be this really amazing gift, although at the time it really didn't feel like it, of course. And one of the teachers on that retreat, who I love, the former German monk Akichno, reminded me of this in one of his talks. He said, "Mindfulness doesn't always feel good. Mindfulness doesn't always feel good. And honestly, it's not supposed to. It's not supposed to always feel good." As the Buddha taught in the First Noble Truth, we're human. So we're all inevitably going to experience suffering, dukkha. It's inescapable if we're human. That's the First Noble Truth. The teacher Joseph Goldstein uses a less intense word to describe the word dukkha or suffering, which I like a little better, which is disappointment. Disappointment. And if you think about it, the experience of disappointment includes almost all the difficult emotions that we experience. Okay? Disappointment with situations, other people, life, the way we want it to be. We're disappointed in that. And especially ourselves. We get disappointed in ourselves when we don't live up to our expectations, right? So I like that word disappointment a little bit. Suffering just seems suffering, so heavy, you know. Like not liking my orange juice or something is not suffering. I did like it. I don't know why I came up with that example. So, you know, but yet, whenever we're experiencing pain or disappointment, for whatever reason, because we're human, there is a very strong tendency in us to make it, the suffering, the disappointment, and then therefore ourselves wrong, right? We identify it. We make ourselves wrong. And believe me that it took so long for me to learn this, and I still sometimes forget. For about a decade or so, whenever I would have these private interviews that we were going to be having with my mentor, Tara Brock, I would come to her usually about day three or four and, you know, all my stuff is up, you know, which is embarrassing to bring to Tara. And she would always say to me over and over and over, she'd say, Shell, you're making it wrong. I mean, for a long time, Shell, you're making it wrong. And what she meant by that was I was making the emotion wrong and therefore me wrong. I was attaching. I could not detach from that. Even after all those years, we go back to our habitual patterns. That's what I found myself doing on that 2-week retreat. I was making it wrong. So, for instance, even though I knew intellectually that a sense of guilt is a very natural part of the grieving process, isn't it? I was beating myself up a bit ruthlessly with this guilt. I had what you might call a gigantic case of the shoulds, which, by the way, are always toxic. So, you know, whenever, it's really good to catch them. They're like flies in a way. Ooh, caught one, you know, caught one, got another one, or should. And my shoulds included things like, I should have recognized that my friend's headaches during those last 6 months, you know, were signs of brain tumor. I should have known this somehow. I should have urged her to go to the hospital. I should have believed her sometimes when she was complaining of yet another headache. She had a lot of allergies and things, and I just thought she was making excuses because she was doing it a lot, that she was upset with me for some reason. You know, why are you going home so early all the time? So I also had a great sense of survivor's guilt. So on retreat up in Massachusetts, this beautiful retreat center, these gigantic trees and forests and long walking, just beautiful. And whenever I experience like even a slight like fluttering of joy, like a burst of sunlight in the fields or a butterfly along the trail, I felt again like I shouldn't be able to enjoy it. I felt guilty for enjoying it because she wasn't there to enjoy it as well. And you might recognize some of these things when you're grieving. And of course, I was also going through all the things in my head that I hadn't done perfectly with my friend. I should have done this. I should have done that. I should have said that. I should have done, you know, been better, should have been a better person. And I was, as they like to say, I was shooting all over myself. It's a good way to remember that the shoulds are toxic. And what happened is all of this guilt was, and shame and grief was arising in the body and mind. I was making the pain of it so much worse by battling with it. I went to war with it. So I was trying to push it away, fix it, make it go away, and at the same time also making the guilty thoughts and my grief and myself wrong, okay? To be honest, in retrospect, I think that it was so soon and the grief was so big and heavy that I just wasn't willing to allow myself to feel it yet. So I was doing these mental exercises to kind of avoid it. And because of all these judgments I had, all my toxic shoulds, the biggest obstacle that I was believing, I was really hooked into, was that I was somehow undeserving. I was somehow undeserving of allowing myself compassion for my grief, allowing my grief. Again, so a way of not feeling it, I was doing my very best to use my thinking mind to talk myself out of it, which in so many ways is actually the exact opposite of compassion when we're trying to talk ourselves out of it using our thinking mind. One of my teachers, and I can't remember who, described this strategy as like trying to bring your troubles to a sad, worried, judgmental person. Has that ever worked out for anybody? How does that work for you? Right? But we do that to ourselves. So you might try to consider this or try to remember whenever you're feeling sad or angry or disappointed, who do you really want to be with? Who do you really want to be with when you're sad or angry, disappointed? Is it that anxious person who interrupts you, showers you with solutions? You should do this. Who loves unsolicited advice? Anybody? That person, yeah. Or maybe it's that frustrated person who maybe even yells at you, tells you just to stop being sad or angry, stop it. Or maybe even blames you, you know, for being, you shouldn't be upset. What's wrong with you? Right? Or is it that person that simply leans forward, gives you a warm, kind smile, just listens and nods their head, maybe rests their hands in yours, or sets their hand on your shoulder while you cry? Or maybe even it's that person who hands you a tissue as the snot is running down your face and laughs with you, right? It's that person that you want to be with. So with this type of offering, this type of being with, present with, there's no fixing. And there's definitely no judging. It's a kind of pure, gentle, kind presence with a warm heart that is simply present with you, completely allowing your pain without any judgment. Okay? So this is exactly what we want to learn to do for ourselves. And it's really the very essence of compassion, Karuna, the second of the Brahma Viharas. Karuna is what metta or friendliness feels when it encounters suffering. It simply wants the suffering to stop without judging who is suffering, right? It's not conditional. Zen philosopher Alaric Hutchinson says it this way: love is being able to view a situation without adding duality to it. Love is being able to view a situation without adding duality to it. The Buddhist texts describe compassion as the quivering of the heart, in response to the recognition of suffering. And compassion is in fact a verb. It involves a movement of the heart, a doing. Right? So when you're trying to remember that quivering, it's a doing. It involves asking your heart, what is the most compassionate thing to do here? What is the most compassionate thing to do here? So I like to think of it, it's that impulse in us to jump directly in the river when we see that somebody's drowning, right? We don't need to know who that person is or judge whether they're worth saving. We don't stand on the bridge going, is that person a Democrat or Republican? I don't know, you know. We just jump in because we recognize that they're suffering. There's no thought in it. There's only heart responding directly, wanting the suffering to stop, okay? And I want to step back here just for a moment and talk a little bit about what compassion is not. So clearly it's not cruelty, right? Which is considered the far enemy of compassion, which is the furthest away, and which is its opposite, which is really easy to see, cruelty. And by the way, sometimes we can feel like we're being cruel when we're actually being compassionate. Like, for instance, when we tell someone no. Anybody feel that? Oh, I'm a B-I-T-C-H, or I'm a terrible person. And sometimes you got to look at it. Sometimes it's the most compassionate thing to do, to set a clear boundary, okay? Or to stop someone from hurting someone or themselves. Sometimes that's so you can look at that. Is this cruel or is this not? Is this compassion? It starts to get tricky when we equate compassion with what's considered its near enemy, which means it's so close that it's hard to miss sometimes, which is pity, okay? Pity implies feeling sorry for someone in a way that separates the two of you, that puts you somehow above the other person. So with pity, you're somehow putting yourself above, which also means you're disconnecting from your heart, and it's a way to not allow you, yourself, to feel the pain. Compassion means that you can look at someone suffering and see clearly that you also experience that same type of pain. It also implies that you could easily see yourself in their situation, given all the different causes and conditions, experiences, life, upbringing, everything that's happened to us. Given all of that, that person might have been us. We might be that person, okay? It's just causes and conditions. So for instance, you might see a homeless person and feel pity and somehow feel better than, instead of truly recognizing that given all the causes and conditions, experiences, this could also be you. What can help with seeing whether you're offering pity or compassion is just to bring to mind how you felt maybe as a child when someone was kind and compassionate to you, really, truly kind and compassionate. Just think about that for a moment. Was there a time in your childhood that you remember that someone was just deeply compassionate, kind in some way to you, and how that felt? And now maybe you can try to think of a time when someone offered you pity. What did that feel like? Has anybody ever offered pity? Kind of feels like the opposite, doesn't it? You've ever been on the receiving end of pity? Because it's a separation. And the truth is, the same goes for when you feel pity for yourself. It's a little bit of self-abuse, because you are, in essence, identifying with a sense of self that somehow is deserving of pity. So check that out, okay? Are you offering compassion to yourself? Or are you offering something that looks a little bit more like pity? Because pity has an identity to it, okay? Just look at that. And again, whenever you're having pity in the heart, means that you're also in some way cutting yourself off from your own heart. Because, like cruelty, pity stops us from really connecting with the pain of other people. True compassion also has no expectation of reward or even a simple thank you, okay? When you're expecting something in return, you are again separating yourself and making yourself in some way better than by helping. I'm helping that person, right? So where are you on the continuum if you're helping? So with compassion, we practice the Buddhist ideal of dana paramita, the perfection of giving, which means no giver, no receiver. When we're offering compassion, no giver, no receiver. In the very same way, compassion does not include a kind of selfish wish to help someone stop suffering so that we will feel more comfortable, right? So we all know what that is, right? Can you please stop feeling that? So that here's some suggestions so that I don't, because I feel really uncomfortable with your suffering. You know, and it's another way that we close off our hearts, you know, to other people's suffering. And again, what happens in that case, instead of compassion, what we're really offering is an attempt to fix so that it will go away. It's a form of aversion. It's a not wanting. So whenever we're trying to fix, what we're really saying is, I am unwilling to be with your suffering or pain because it's in some way wrong. It shouldn't be. Your pain and suffering is some way in wrong, so we're going to fix it, okay? Our practice is asking us to do the exact opposite. which is to courageously open our hearts to the suffering and begin to recognize more and more the truth of the first noble truth, which is that everyone suffers, all of us, and that we are all united in both our suffering and our wish to be happy. It is what connects us. That's what I love about the Buddhist practice. Such an emphasis on suffering, but there's so much connection and heart in suffering because it's what connects us. The Buddhist nun Pema Chodron says, sorrow has the exact same taste for all of us. Sorrow has the exact same taste for all of us. Remembering that our deepest wounding, the thing that causes the most suffering in us, is a sense of feeling separate. That's a source of our deepest suffering. If you look at anything, check that out. So just as with metta practice, with all practice, in order to start to deepen our capacity for compassion, we first need to become aware of the suffering within ourselves. That's where we start, okay? We need to be courageous enough to allow it and really get to know our own suffering so that we can know what it feels like and looks like in others, okay? And again, Ami Pema Chodron tells us, in order to have compassion for others, we have to have compassion for ourselves. In particular, to care about other people who are fearful, angry, jealous, overpowered by addictions of all kinds, arrogant, proud, miserly, selfish, mean, you name it. To have compassion and to care for these people means not to run from the pain of finding these things in ourselves. Okay? Not to run from the pain of finding these things in ourselves. And if we're really honest with ourselves, what happens when those things come up? What do we want to do? Do we want to embrace it? No. We want to get rid of it because it's wrong, right? And so often our tendency is also to be a bit selective and limited about who we offer our compassion to, right? Because we tend to judge people as either worthy or not worthy of our compassion. So for instance, it might be super easy to offer compassion to our beloveds, to our friends, family, people that we find easy to love. It also might feel super easy to offer compassion to those that we see are in obvious pain or suffering in some way that might seem extreme to us. But it might often be much more difficult to offer our compassion to those who seem to be enjoying what appears to be the good conditions in life, maybe very good conditions in our eyes. And it's especially difficult to offer our compassion to those who might be engaging in harmful actions towards other people, right? But if we're really honest, perhaps the person that we find it the most difficult to offer our compassion to is ourselves, isn't it? How many people are hard on themselves in here? Every hand, right? Yeah. So we tend to judge ourselves more than anyone else on the entire planet, really. Happily, as the Buddha so widely taught us, you can search through the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. Someone who is more deserving. There is no person who is more deserving. You are equally as deserving of your kindness and compassion. So through our practice, we can really start to understand what compassion means by starting to become that kind, calm, non-judgmental, compassionate presence for ourselves with all our human flaws and struggles, all our shit, okay? That's how we learn. We need to learn to become compassionate listeners for ourselves and practice this, so that we can offer this kind of listening, kind presence to others. We start with ourselves. So instead of judging, blaming, trying to fix, trying to get rid of, running away from our suffering, we can begin to learn to become for ourselves that person that we really wish would be with us, right? That person. We do that for ourselves. We learn to hold ourselves and our pain with great care and kindness. We let ourselves know that however we're feeling, it's not wrong. It's really okay. And that we're right here for ourselves. We're not going anywhere. We're not going anywhere. We're right here. Even with all our flaws and conditioning, we don't have to be perfect to love ourselves. Actually, the opposite, right? And this sounds so simple, I'm making it sound so simple, but as most of you know, the self-compassion takes a lot of practice and patience and a lot of courage. It takes courage because it's really asking us to not look away, to be fully present and in touch with our own pain, as well as the thoughts and beliefs and behaviors that are fueling it. In the words of author and Buddhist scholar Joanna Macy, we're learning to sustain the gaze. We're learning to sustain the gaze. Or as Rumi urges us, don't turn away. Keep your gaze on the bandaged place. That is where the light enters you. So in our practice, whenever we can recognize that we're struggling or suffering, we can begin by dropping out of the thinking mind and kindly allow our feelings to be here, allow ourselves to just be with the actual physical sensations in the body. Because our emotions, if you look at them, they're physical sensations in the body, aren't they? What are we afraid of? What are we so afraid of? Feeling. So for me, on that two-week retreat, what I began to notice and allow is the gripping and tightness, squeeze in my heart and throat, you know, that feeling like someone was pressing into my chest, this kind of deep heaviness that just felt like rocks through my whole body, kind of a sense of just deep tiredness, drained tiredness, and also a lot of sensitivity and anxiousness, okay? So I was exploring, what does grief feel like in the body? What does this feel like? And when you're allowing and holding your emotions, you might think of it as a way that you hold a child who might be really crying and afraid because maybe they think a monster's under the bed. It's an old analogy, but, you know, they're crying and they're afraid. So you don't berate the child for crying, right? Or tell them that they're wrong or they're crazy. What do? You simply hold them, right? And you tell them, it's okay, I know you're afraid. I know you're afraid. Come here. It's okay. It's okay. That's how we allow with compassion, with that kind of intimacy, like we would, and kindness that we would give a child. This kind of compassionate allowing might even invite a deep letting go, as it did with me on retreat. I actually ended up going for a really long walk in the woods and finding a big rock, and I literally just sat down and sobbed. I don't know for how long, maybe over an hour. I just literally sat with, think of the big rock, just sat with my grief and myself. After I'd allowed myself to feel the pain of it, I could then start questioning what I was believing. I could start questioning my shoulds, okay? So with this, it's kind of like the idea that child who is frightened by this monster under the bed. Once that child has calmed down a bit and their tears have cleared, you might gently start to ask them questions like, honey, what are you afraid of? Or, why do you believe there's a monster under the bed? You know, those kind of questions. And with our practice, we can be that same compassionate friend to ourselves and ask our feelings the same questions. So I want to emphasize here that this is not an intellectual process. We do not go for comfort to the thinking mind. We don't go here, okay? We drop out of the analytical, judgmental mind and go directly to the feelings themselves. We go to our wise hearts, okay? So for instance, we might ask our hearts, heart, what are you believing or feeling? feeling? What are you believing? You know, if you're angry, don't ask your head what you're angry about. You already know that. How many times have you thought about that scenario, right? It's going to tell you the same story. You say anger. Anger, what are you believing? Or what are you needing? Okay, we ask the feelings. And then, like that compassionate, wise person who's with the frightened child, we can take our own hands, if you will, and gently show ourselves that the monster is not real. Oh, let's look under the bed, honey. Look, that's not true. That's not accurate. So we can start to see that a little more clearly, that the beliefs that are fueling our suffering isn't necessarily true, even though the feelings themselves are. Okay, it's that real but not true. The feelings are real, but the beliefs might not be true, and it's really okay. So for instance, on my retreat, as I continued to sit for those 2 weeks with the full pain of my grief, as I touched it, held it, let it be without trying to fix it or change it, offer commentary or solutions, as I sat with it, there arose a voice within me that simply said, very clearly in my mind, please don't abandon me. I heard it so clearly. Please be with me. Please, please don't abandon me. So every time I found myself being pulled away but into the dream world of thought and the shoulds would come up again. They would rise their, you know, dragon heads. I would hear the voice. It was, please don't abandon me. And I would again be willing to come back and just stay with my body, with however it was feeling. And I realized at that moment, after a while of practice, that I was finally offering myself the self-compassion that I needed, agreeing to not abandon myself. And after a while, what happened was that the pain started to become warm, and the feeling started to become warm, and then there were more tears, and the breathing kind of slowed. And finally, there was just this warm, glowing, loving kind of peacefulness within me. And in surrendering, complete surrender to the pain, in giving up the fixing, I realized there is so much pain in the world, so much judgment, jealousy, disappointment, that the only thing left is kindness and compassion. That's what remains. It's love. It's what all the world's teachings are pointing to, including the Buddhist teachings. In the end, what matters is that there's love. There is an acceptance of our flawed humanness. You know, it's that Jesus died for our sins. God loves us unconditionally. It's that thing. What we're training ourselves to do over and over is to love ourselves without any conditioning, any requirements, without any shoulds. And as we learn to do this, that love inevitably starts to flow out to others. And it becomes that sense of, let me just be love. Let me merge with that. Let me be love. So more and more as we practice opening our hearts to the pain of life, the inevitable dukkha, that much more we open our hearts to connection with all things and discover the exquisite joy of not feeling separated from anyone or anything in this world. That's where the joy comes. The teacher Ram Dass describes this so beautifully. He says, the most important aspect of love is not in the giving or the receiving. It is in the being. When I need love from others or need to give love to others, I am caught in an unstable situation. Being in love, rather than giving or taking love, is the only thing that provides stability. Being in love means seeing the beloved all around me. Okay. So I think I'm actually going to end there and invite you all just to into a brief meditation just for a moment. So just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. Maybe a couple of rounds of these on your own. Settling here with yourself. And I'm going to invite those of you who would like to just place one hand on the heart, one hand on the belly, breathing into the fingers, feeling the body moving, feeling the heart, the breath. I'm just going to invite you to just take a moment to consider anything that you're judging about yourself as wrong in some way, any emotion, thought, identity. What are your shoulds? Are you shoulding yourself this weekend? Is there any judgment? Just notice. I should be this way. This should be different. They should be different. Just let whatever is here arise so you can see it. Put it up to the light. What are you battling with? I'm going to invite you to courageously consider what emotion is underneath the should that you're not willing to look at or feel. What's underneath the should? What feeling is underneath the should or the judgment? And can you just allow it to be here without trying to fix it, change it, make it go away? And can you hold this feeling in yourself with kindness and compassion? It's okay. Remembering that the thoughts are likely untrue, but the feeling's real. It's not wrong. Could you be that kind, compassionate, gentle presence, that friend who's just with you with this pain? Whatever it is. You might even try on the phrase, I care about this suffering. I care about this suffering. If it's helpful, you might even imagine holding yourself as a child. Offering yourself that care. With a deep recognition that others also experience the same hurt and vulnerability. And could you connect with that and offer your kindness out, compassion out, to all those who are also feeling whatever this is. If the mind wanders, simply come back to the heart, the hand on the heart, that sense of holding, allowing, being that kind presence, being love for yourself, being love for yourself. And if it's you feel blocked or numb, maybe just setting an intention to allow, to be kinder, more compassionate. Finally, just listening to these words by Babaji, contemporary Indian master who writes, "My beloved child, break your heart no longer. Each time you judge yourself, you break your own heart. You stop feeding on the love which is the wellspring of your vitality. The time has come. Your time to live, to celebrate, and to see the goodness that you are. Let no one, no thing, no idea or ideal obstruct you. And if one comes, even in the name of truth, forgive it for its unknowing. Do not fight. Let go and breathe into the goodness that you are."